I'd like to introduce our speaker, a good friend of the Conscious Contact Speaker Group, Roy T. from Long Island, New York.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Roy. And by the grace of a power greater than myself, I haven't found it necessary to drink today. And by the grace of that same power, I haven't found it necessary to drink for over 25 years, for which I'm really grateful. And so are people in at least three other countries that you haven't even met yet. And yes, the flyer did say I'm from India, and I guess you figured out from my accent by now that I'm not from around here. But if you were expecting to hear somebody who sounds like the guy at the end of the AT&T phone, "Hello, please, this is Sam from..." That's not me. I could do that if you want, but not for a whole meeting, so... I'm so nervous. This is crazy. I love being nervous because that keeps me honest. My home group is the Road to Freedom group of Bombay, India, and my current home group is the Baldwin group of Long Island. So I have two of my friends here with me tonight, and they just came along to make sure that I was going to keep it honest because, you know, they heard some rumors that I tend to say things that didn't actually happen if someone isn't watching. And I did a lot of that when I was out there drinking. So what usually happens at an AA meeting is that people share their story of what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. And that's what I'd like to do. I grew up in a middle-class family in Bombay. My parents were both dental surgeons. And in my socioeconomic circle growing up, alcohol was accepted. I can remember from way back when I was a kid, we'd always be given a glass of my grandmother's homemade wine at dinner or on days and occasions of national importance. And when you grow up in India, there are plenty of days and occasions of national importance between the Hindus, the Muslims, the Buddhists, the Jewish, the Catholics, the Protestants, and lots of days and occasions. So alcohol was not something strange. My parents entertained every weekend. And I can remember as a kid growing up, you know, their friends would start arriving at around 7:30 or thereabouts. They'd have a few drinks. They'd be singing around the piano. There'd be laughter. They'd have dinner. There might be some dancing. They'd have dessert, and then they'd go home. And on really late nights, that would be like about 11 o'clock. Did not resemble the kind of parties I went for. There was no vomiting. There was no pushing and shoving. There was no obscene name calling. People actually went home with their own spouses or whoever they came with. They didn't lose their keys or their motorcycles or their cars. And but to me, it was, this is what people do with alcohol. They have a few drinks, they have a few laughs, and they move on. Now into this mix, we had my grandmother's brother. This guy was really cool. So he would come straight to the back room where we kids were hanging out, and he would tell us these incredible stories of how he got pulled over by a cop and talked his way about it, and how he almost lost his job, and how he almost crashed his bike. And we'd be sitting there as kids, open mouthed, saying, "Wow, what an exciting life, man." And he had this odd quirk. He would always have this little gray bag over his shoulder. And at various intervals, he'd make this funny move where he would pull this bag up to his mouth and put his head down to the bag and he would be all happy and jolly again and tell us another story. And then he would give us money and send us to the store to buy peanuts or cigarettes or whatever people have when they drink. And you know what we are like. He was like that. He was one of those keep the change kind of fellas. And he could never remember whether he gave us $5 or whether he gave us $50. And I quickly figured out that if I loitered at the store long enough, he would not remember whether he gave me money or not, and he'd give me money all over again. So needless to say, I started on my criminal career long before I started on my alcoholic career. But the reason I bring up this uncle is because he could be counted on to do something spectacular every time. He'd break a bottle of my dad's best scotch. He'd take a header into the birthday cake. You know, he'd drop the entree, and then we wouldn't see him for a month of Sundays. But he was kind, and he was funny, and he was loving, and he was generous, and he told the greatest stories, and he tipped generously. And I wanted to be like him when I grew up. Needless to say, I got my wish. I got to be an alcoholic and get to Alcoholics Anonymous. His story didn't quite end that way. He was coming home from work one day. Am I too close to this mic? He was coming home from... Is that better? No? Okay. I'm really bad at these things. Tilt it up. Is that better? All right. You're waving at the back. You can't hear me, or you can? You can. That's great. I'm terrible. Just edit that out and we'll... But he was working in the airlines, and he used to ride motorcycles. And one night he was coming home from work and crashed his motorcycle, hit his head on the curb, and died a couple of days later. And I can clearly remember my cousin Neil and I, we had promised him that we would empty a bottle of booze on his grave after the funeral. So we snuck back to the cemetery, and even while we were emptying the booze on his grave, I was thinking to myself, what a waste of good booze. I'm sure he'd have wanted me to, you know, really celebrate his passing by finishing this, but I kept my word. So that was really my introduction to alcohol and what I now know to be alcoholism. You know, a lot of excessive drinking, a lot of storytelling, telling, and a lot of really untoward incidents that happen, some voluntarily and some not so voluntarily. But I progressed along my own alcoholic career. The first change was when we got into double digits. So we got graduated from my grandmother's homemade wine to this concoction the British left behind in India called Shandy. So apparently you can take an inch of beer and top up the glass with lemonade, and then it's okay to give to kids. So we got graduated Shandy, and I have a clear recollection of being 10 or 11 years old and sitting there with my glass of Shandy in my hand and my dad sitting there with his glass of beer. And I felt so grown up. I felt so part of. I felt so accepted. I felt this is great. You know, Bill W. says in a story, I had arrived. That's what I felt with that glass of Shandy in my hand. And so life went on a little more, and when we finished high school, the day after high school, three friends, we decided to go out mountain climbing. There are plenty of mountains around Bombay where I grew up, and I don't know whose idea it was, but somebody said, hey, now that we finished high school and we are real men, we were all of 16, let's go and get some of the real thing. And of course, we were not talking about Coca-Cola at that point. So we walked into a liquor store and we bought two bottles of beer. And you don't need ID to buy anything in India. In fact, you don't need ID to do anything in India, but that's a whole different thing. So we picked up these two bottles of beer, and I've lived here for almost 20 years. All I can, and I get frazzled trying to convert from the metric system to the imperial system, and they were 750 milliliters of beer, whatever that is in American, 40s, 80s, 120s, whatever the biggest can or bottle of beer is, that's it. So we had these two bottles of beer, and they were in my bag, and off we went hiking up the mountain, and we got to the top, hot and sweaty and tired. And of course, none of us budding Einsteins had thought to bring an opener along. We'd gone hiking. But being Boy Scouts, we fiddled around with sticks and stones, and we got the bottle open. And you know, the man who carries the bottle gets the first swig. I mean, it's a universal law. So I had the bottle in my hand. And now for a kid who's only been drinking his grandmother's homemade sweet wine and this lemonade-infected beer for 16 years, I'm raising this bottle to my mouth and saying, oh my God, what is this disgusting stench? You know, it smelled pretty bad. And then I had my first swig and it tasted even worse going down. And in my mind, I'm thinking, what on earth do grown-ups find in this vile concoction? But of course, I was a real man, so I wiped my mouth, wow, this is great, and I passed it to the next guy. And I'm assuming they were as big liars as I was, because they pretended to like it too. But by the time that bottle came back around to me, the beer had hit me. And whoa, all of a sudden, I realized what grown-ups found in that concoction. It was amazing, my head felt great. The breeze was refreshing, the view was spectacular, my tiredness had melted away, and I had developed an incredible thirst. Those two bottles were gone before you could say Jack Robinson and I wanted more. I volunteered to get some more. And so I climbed back down the mountain, and I wasn't monkeying around with beer anymore, and I came back with a bottle of rum. I've been a rum drinker for the rest of my alcoholic career. I mean, I'm not saying that I discriminated against any other forms of alcohol. I would drink whatever there was. But if I was actually given a choice, I would drink rum. And so I came back up the mountain and we drank that rum. I remember the first couple of shots. And I can honestly tell you that that's all I remember about that weekend. I can only tell you from the evidence that went home from me what must have happened. There must have been vomiting because some of that evidence got into my sleeping bag for some reason. There must have been some fighting because I had some inexplicable bruises on various parts of my anatomy. And somehow one of my shirts happened to have got burnt, probably in the campfire. But that's about all I can remember about that weekend. So I had my first blackout. But that's not the worst part. The worst part is that one of those two guys is still not talking to me. And this was December 1st, 1977. If you think that's bad, the other guy won't tell me why the first guy is not talking to me. So that's one blackout that I'm not in a hurry to have catch up with me. So that was my introduction into alcoholism. Potential alcoholic that I was, I said, it was a great weekend. I don't remember what happened. All I know is I felt really good. And then off I went to college. Now, when you grow up in India and you're living with your mom and dad and they're paying all the bills, you basically don't have any rights. You just do what they tell you to do. And my parents, in their infinite wisdom, decided that I was going to become a dental surgeon. So they decided to send me off to college to study dentistry. And with apologies to any dentists who may be present, you know, I had no desire to spend the rest of my life looking into people's mouths. I could think of plenty of other interesting things to do with people's mouths and you know, but when, at last, some like-minded people. but when you're at the mercy of these parents who are paying all their bills, you do what they tell you to do. So off I went to college, and now I embarked upon a really interesting part of my alcoholic career, because college was a great experience. It was really fabulous. I strongly recommend it to anybody. If you've never been to college, please go. I never actually graduated, but it was still a fabulous experience. It took me 3 years to get through 1 year of college, and then they booted me out. What did I actually do in college? We would spend Monday to Thursday making plans of what to do from Thursday to Sunday. Because as any alcoholic knows, the weekend starts on Thursday. And I got to tell you, between Thursday and Sunday, we would put whatever we could put into our bodies in whichever way it went in. And I promise you, I use substances that were not always alcoholic, but I used them very alcoholically. I used too much and I couldn't stop, and they got me into trouble. But for some reason, I apparently was the guy that could drink the most, I could drive the straightest, I could tell the most believable yarns. So whenever we were dropping people off home, I was the guy elected to go and tell their mom why he's not feeling well and he just needs to rest. And every Monday morning, it was the same story again. We'd get together on the basketball court, and by putting together various pieces of our blackouts, we try to figure out what we did over the weekend. And, you know, this went on, as I said, for 3 years. And this was a fine Jesuit institution in Bombay. And one day the principal called me in and told me that St. Xavier's College had been around for 125 years. And he assured me that they would survive without my meager contribution. I mean, I was really ticked off, caught a real resentment. And I said, you know what? If that's the way they want it, I'm going to show them. I don't really need their college or their education. And I started working full-time. Prior to that, I was working part-time in a travel agency. I was a tour guide. I would take people around India, Nepal, and Sri Lanka. And it was really good because drinking came with the job and a lot of other perks, let me say. And so I started working full-time at Bombay Airport. I got into the airline business, and it was paradise for an alcoholic like me. You know, I worked night shifts. I worked in cargo. There was always interesting stuff happening in cargo. You got to deal with the guys in catering. Somehow, a lot of the bonded liquor seemed to have got misplaced on their way from the aircraft to the bonded warehouse, and it was a lot of fun. What changed? My drinking changed. The first thing that changed was when I went from being a Thursday to Sunday drinker to being a daily drinker. That was the first change in my drinking. I can't say on what day or on what occasion it happened. I just knew that one day I was just having a couple of drinks every day. And a couple of drinks has never really cut it for me, that I always had to have more. And so the quantity of liquors that I started to drink went up. That was the first change. The second thing that got affected was finances. Because now I didn't have as much money in my pocket because I was spending so much money on my liquor bills. The third thing that got affected was my relationship. At this point, I was engaged to be married to my high school sweetheart. At least in India, when you know you're engaged, you're expected to occasionally show up with flowers or chocolates and take her out for dinner. And when she says, "When are we getting married, honey?" you don't say "next year, honey" for 10 years in a row. So that would lead to a whole lot of incredible arguments. And that's when I discovered these two really magical, miraculous properties that alcohol had. The first was temporary deafness. I could see her mouth moving, but I couldn't hear anything that was coming out. So that was pretty good. Pour me another one. Oh, what, you said what? And then the second magical property was temporary amnesia. Because the next morning I wouldn't remember. You said this and you said that and you... I can't remember. Next time, make me write it down. You guys should see my writing when I'm drunk. That's a whole nother story. So I became a daily drinker. I was increasing the amounts I was drinking. It was draining me financially, and it started to affect my relationship. The next thing that got affected was work. Because now when you started drinking as much as I was drinking, you start going to work hungover almost every day. And, you know, this is not one of my, this is not a part of my career that I'm proud about. But I would go to work, I'd be hungover, I'd grab a chart, and I'd be walking from one end of Bombay Airport to the other, pretending to look for a lost bag or a lost cow or a lost child or something or the other. And I'm just working my hangover off. And this might also be a good time for me to make public amends. Because, you know, when you work in cargo, you're also responsible for baggage handling. And when you're as hungover as I am, when this bag's coming down the conveyor belt, you don't know whether it's saying Vladivostok or Vancouver, and you just tell the porter, throw it over there, it'll get there somehow. So if anyone has ever lost a bag on Transworld Airlines or Pan Am or Kuwait Airways or Gulf Air or Ethiopian Airlines or Delta, it was probably me. I apologize. All I can tell you is what I do now when I travel, I take carry-on only. Wherever I go, I buy a couple of shirts. Who needs clothes on vacations anyway? So, you know, bosses don't like it when you start showing up hungover and sending the wrong cargo to the wrong destination and wrong bags to the wrong place. And they start giving you these little love letters called memos. Oh, why don't you go and work for that airline over there? I think they have a vacancy. And that's really bad when they start sending you off to the opposition to work. So now that started getting affected. And now, of course, my drinking kept going on. I kept blacking out. I kept not remembering. I kept fighting with my fiance. I kept getting broke. Next thing that started to get affected was my health. And now I got an enlarged liver. I was only 26 years old. I said, that's insane. I said to the doctor, how could I have an enlarged liver? I only drink Bacardi. The doctor said, your liver doesn't care what it drinks. You have an enlarged liver. So fortunately for me, I discovered this herbal remedy one can use if you're trying to not drink. I believe it's also legal in a couple of states in the USA now. So I smoked this herbal remedy for 3 months, and I didn't drink. And anybody who's not had a drink for 3 months can't possibly be an alcoholic. And so I started drinking once again. Things got worse. I went through 4 airlines. I started a business, and that failed. I changed careers completely. I got into the film and television industry. I became a production manager there. I started using a heck of a lot of other substances. I know I made a couple of references to other substances here, and I want to pay my respects to a fellow called Dr. Bob, co-founder of AA. I really found my identification in Dr. Bob's story. Dr. Bob shares how he would wake up in the morning and his hands would be shaking so badly. And he was a proctologist, so, you know, he can't have shaking hands when he goes to work. And he couldn't take a drink because he's meeting with patients. So Dr. Bob says in a story in the Big Book that he would fill up on pills to stop the shakes, to go to work, to make enough money, to drink some more. And so, you know, like I said, alcohol is not the only substance I use, but whatever I use very alcoholically. And so now, you know, things have really got bad. I'm sliding towards the bottom really quickly. About this time, the engagement broke up. Did I say that? So the jobs have gone, the business is gone, the engagement is gone. I'm now in my third enlarged liver probably. And then I crashed a motorcycle. And yes, I know I don't look like a biker now, but I promise you when my hair was longer and if my shirt was off, you would see the evidence. And towards the end, every morning was the same. I would wake up every morning years first, and I tried to figure out from the sounds in the next room or from the lack of sounds and how I came home the night before. If I heard all those everyday breakfasty kind of sounds, you know, plates and forks, I said, okay, I came home okay. I don't know what happened, but I came home okay. But if I heard that cold, appalling, deadly silence, and I knew there were bodies in the next room waiting to question me and say, oh my God, what did I do last night? And then some jackass would usually call me at that point and tell me, oh, you know what you did? Oh my God. All of a sudden I'd be reconnected with God. Why reconnected? My parents came from two different religious backgrounds. My father's side of the family is Catholic. My mother's side of the family is Hindu. So depending which grandmother I was spending the weekend with, I would be assured that the other half was the wrong kind and going to a warm place. So me and God parted company really early, except when I would be waking up every morning drunk and broke and sick and alone and covered in urine and vomit. At least I hope it was my own urine and vomit. I was running with a pretty rough crowd towards the end. And I would be reconnected with God. Please reach for my wallet. I hope there's money in there. There'd usually just be pieces of paper with something scribbled. No idea what it was. Was it a job offer? Was it an IOU? Was it the number of some unfortunate woman who actually spent 3 minutes with me? And then make a beeline for the door and run before anyone can ask you a question which demands an intelligent reply. And swear to myself, I am never going to do this again. Only to be replaced with, well, I'm never going to do this till Thursday. Only to be replaced with, well, let me just get through this day and this evening I'll have a couple of wet ones. Only to be replaced by, I'm not even going to get through to 11 o'clock, man, if I don't have something. That's what it was at the end. The constant promises, the constant trials, the constant failures, the big book talks about, you know, the four hideous horsemen of terror and bewilderment and frustration and despair. And that was me. Frustrated. How have I landed up in this situation again? And bewildered. I was not an idiot. I mean, I may not have finished college, but I was well read. I knew what was right and wrong. I knew what was wrong. How could I be in this situation again? You know, and then the terror. This is never going to end. I'm going to be like this forever. And the despair. There's no way out. I might as well get high. That's what it was at the end. That's what it was like. That's what my drinking was like. It was fun for a while, a very short while, and then was steadily downhill. What happened? Alcoholics Anonymous happened. So the first time I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 18 years old. So I was already well into 2 years of blackout drinking. I was already into 2 years of problematic drinking. And I was reading a book called The Second Deadly Sin. It's about a New York City detective who's chasing an ice pick killer. And the lieutenant in the story is in AA and he's having a relapse in... Or the detective's having a relapse, and I'm reading the story, and you know, I got a little uncomfortable when they were describing some of the symptoms of alcoholism. But in my mind, it registered that if you have a drinking problem, there's some place called AA where you can go for help. So I just filed that away for future reference. You know, I never knew whom I might need to help or send to AA, and I carried on drinking. The second time I got the message of AA, I was 22. I think I was with TWA at the time, and I just come off a night shift. I was sitting on the front porch, and my grandmother was coming home from church 6 o'clock in the morning. I was on my third rum and water, and she said, what are you, an alcoholic, drinking at 6 in the morning? So I went into this long, convoluted explanation as to how people who work night shifts at airports need to come home and have a couple of drinks so they can sleep through the traffic. She wasn't having any of that. She said, you better go and meet Uncle Tony and his friends who don't drink. So now this one uncle crashed his bike and died, but she had another brother, my Uncle Tony, whom I later found out was the fourth man to get sober in India in 1957. So she said, you better go and meet Uncle Tony and his friends who don't drink. Now I got to tell you, when you're 22, You don't want to be hanging out with Uncle Tony and his friends who don't drink. You know, there's plenty of other interesting things to do. But if you love your grandmother as much as I do, you have a few drinks and you go for this meeting. So, you know, this was a good, I mean, it's an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I had a few drinks. I went for the meeting. You know, I can't remember very much of what actually transpired at that meeting. They may have made a couple of helpful suggestions like put the plug in the jug or keep coming back. Why? But, you know, they wanted my number. I said, didn't you tell me this is an anonymous program? I'm not telling you my number. Uncle Tony very wisely stayed away from the proceedings. You know, he wasn't having anything to do with it. So that was the first time at age 22 I was actually in an AA meeting. Needless to say, I'm not the poster child for AA. I took another 6 years before God saw it fit to separate me from alcohol for the last time. So that was my second introduction. And over the next few years, you know, I would wander haphazardly in and out of AA, depending on how much trouble I'd got into, depending on who was putting pressure on me to go. And I always came back and told them, but AA doesn't work. They said, what do you mean it doesn't work? I said, I'm still drinking. I have a few drinks. I had a pretty good formula. I'd have a few drinks, I'd go 20 minutes late, and then leave 20 minutes early, so that, you know, no one could really figure out what was going on with me. And so needless to say, AA didn't work. So this went on for 6 years. The end came in February of 1990. I was recovering from this motorcycle accident. I was flat in bed. It was pretty bad. I had been in a coma for 7 days. I had 36 stitches in my head. I had 8 compressed vertebrae in my back. My neck was in a collar. My back was in a brace. And of course, I was broken, single, and unemployed again. That was just par for the course. And I could not stop drinking. Like I said, I wasn't an idiot. I'd taken an inventory. I could squarely admit to myself that it was alcohol that had brought me to the condition in life that I was at. And so I decided that 1990 was going to be a dry year. It lasted 10 days. And January 10th, I was after the races again. And near the end of that February, you know, I was really in the dumps. I was drinking around the clock. And I was so depressed, I decided to kill myself. So I climbed up on the ledge to jump. And my younger brother, who also lives in Pennsylvania, his in-laws actually live in Doylestown, and he lives in a town called Dallas near Wilkes-Barre. Just to give, you know, my salams to any Al-Anons who are in the who are sitting over here tonight. Thank you so much. You have kept us alive far longer than we would have managed had it not been for your for your help. I'll leave it at that. But to give you an idea of how my alcoholism affected my family, I was standing on that ledge to jump, and my brother said, jump and put us out of our misery. Of course, once he told me to jump, I'm not going to give him the pleasure. What do you mean jump? So I climbed off the ledge, and the phone rang at that point, and it was his girlfriend. And I broke down, and I boo-hooed. I said, what's going on? So I don't have a job. And she said, well, stop drinking. You know, you got a lot of experience. And I don't have any savings. Well, if you stop drinking and you start working, you'll save some money. And I never finished school. Well, if you stop drinking and you save some money, you can pay to go back to school. And I don't have a girlfriend. Well, you might find someone idiotic enough to go out with you if you're not drinking. And whatever she said, I kept saying, you know, I can't stop drinking. And then she said those awful words again, Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, it doesn't work. I said, I'll tell you what. You find me a doctor who can give me a prescription for antabuse, and I'll go tomorrow morning. And at that time, we had just started the first hospital-based meeting in India. And that meeting was about 2 or 3 months old, 8 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday morning. Of course, she didn't tell me she was taking me to AA. She said, okay, I found a doctor. 8 o'clock tomorrow morning is your appointment. So 8 a.m., I'm sitting in this big room in this hospital, and I'm thinking, wow, this doctor must be really good. So many people here to stop drinking. And then some fool got up and said, hi, my name is Nick, and started reading the preamble of AA. Now, I'd like to tell you that because I was well brought up, I sat and I listened. I was stuck in the corner. I was 50 feet away from the nearest exit. My mom was on one side of me. A huge 300-pound guy was on the other side of me. So I sat down and I listened. I had absolutely nothing in common with the first four. Don't ask me how they did it. It was a one-hour meeting with five speakers. And they had like about 10 minutes each. I had nothing in common with them. You know, one was divorced. I had never even been married. So I had nothing in common with them. One had been to jail. I'd been a guest of the government almost every Saturday night. But jail? Nah, nothing in common with them. And one was old. I was only 28. I was young. I was pretty. I couldn't be beaten. So I said, I'm not like you guys. But the last guy who spoke, the late Horace H., may his soul rest in peace, he talked about the disease of alcoholism. And that got my attention. He said alcoholism is a threefold disease of mind, body, and soul. He said the first part is a mental obsession, so powerful that it'll overcome both the desire and the necessity to stay sober. You might want to, you might need to, but your mind is going to say, go out and have a drink anyway. And I could identify with that. Just 3 months before that, I told you about the motorcycle accident. I woke up from the coma. And as the big book says, I was full of shame and fear and guilt and remorse. And how did I land over here? And my mind said, have a drink, you'll feel better. That's crazy. I had that accident, which in all honesty, it wasn't my fault. I was riding straight and the road turned right. So, you know, and my helmet was on the headlamp like any self-respecting biker. And so when they asked me what happened, I lied. I said there was a cow crossing the street. I went back later and in that particular village, there are plenty of people and plenty of pigs, but no cows in that village. But so I woke up and my mind said, go have a drink, you'll feel better. All of a sudden, I became Mahatma Gandhi. And I called the doctors and I said, I demand a discharge against medical advice. You can put all those sick people here. I'll go back to my hotel and recover. Crossed the street, had a couple of drinks, rented another motorcycle, and rode back to the film unit I was at. Insanity! And when Horace H. was talking about a mental obsession so powerful it'll overcome both the desire and the necessity, I said, that's me. I said, okay, so what's the problem? He said, the problem is the second part is there's a physical factor. If you're an alcoholic, you have some kind of physical factor, an X factor that causes an allergy. He said, do you know anyone who has an allergy? I said, yeah, my sister Trudy Ann. She's allergic to shrimp. I assure you, she does not have to go for meetings of Shrimp Eaters Anonymous and says, I've been fish free for 30 years. She got the information, she just didn't eat it. But he said, if you're an alcoholic, you have one drink, this X factor takes off, and your brain is saying, have two. Your body's saying, give me more, give me more, give me more, give me go. I said, yeah, that's me. And I was the guy, two drinks before dinner, darling. Darling saw plenty of dinners. I was like, two drinks before we left, or nip in my jacket pocket. Oh, dinner served, suddenly I was on the Titanic. Women and children first, I went back to the bar, give me a double. I knew it wasn't even my party. Let's have a nightcap. Hey, you're not even the host. I knew all the... I said, I got that. So he said, and the third part of this illness is a physical bankruptcy. A spiritual bankruptcy. The lying, the cheating. I said, oh, that's not me. You know, I'm a really snobbish kind of alcoholic. I don't do those kind of things. He said, really? Which is the last employer you gave an honest 40 hours of work to? What a low blow. I've never given anyone 40 hours except since I got sober. I said, wow, that's me, I'm in. So what do I have to do? Where's the doctor? Where's the medication? And they pointed to the 12 steps. I said, you guys must be kidding. And I started looking over those steps. And I said, oh, powerless, okay. Okay, I'll have to admit that. Unmanageable, 28, broke, unemployed. Single, no savings, Sleeping on my grandmother's couch. Okay, step one, I can take that. Step two, I don't believe in God, so I don't need that. And step three also has God, so that's out. There's nothing wrong with me, so I don't need step four. I'm not telling you guys anything, so I don't need step five. And since there's nothing wrong with me, I don't need six or seven. You people need some help with step eight, because I have a long list of people that I would like to harm. And I have a longer list of people that owe me amends. Step 10 is obviously out, because there's nothing wrong with me. 11 has God, and that's out. And step 12, I'll tell all my friends in the bar about your little club. So I stayed sober 1 week, and I slipped. And I stayed sober 2 weeks, and I slipped. And I stayed sober 3 weeks, and I slipped again. 22nd of April, 1990. That was the last time I had a slip. And, you know, no coincidences. It was up on a mountain. I was sober 3 weeks. I'd restarted my business. I had a little camping equipment business. And I was up on a mountain. I was visiting some clients. And they said, "Hey, Roy, what are you going to drink? Stay for the campfire." I was too ashamed or embarrassed to tell these people that I was suffering from a fatal life-threatening illness called alcoholism, that I was in AA and sober 3 weeks. I couldn't do it. So I said, "What do you got?" They said, "Oh, we got 2 shots of whiskey in that bottle and a bottle of wine. So this time I'm going to control and enjoy my drinking. I'll drink the whiskey." I told you, I don't discriminate against any form of alcohol. So I said, "I'll have the whiskey." I had the 2 shots of whiskey. The allergy got triggered. Those lightweights finished half a bottle of wine, and anyone here is going to leave half a bottle of wine behind when everyone else is done. So I finished the wine. I did not get drunk. It was a wonderful evening. We played the guitar, we sang around the campfire, no blackouts, no hangovers. Great evening. Hiking down the mountain the next morning to take the train back to Bombay, that kept going through my mind. Why did you pick up? Why did you pick up? Why did you pick up? You know, and from deep down within me, for the first time, I had my moment of truth. And I had to say, I picked up because I did not have the mental power to say no. I was mentally powerless over alcohol. That's the first time I admitted to my innermost self. I started meetings and, "Hi, my name's Roy, I'm an alcoholic." Never admitted to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic and powerless. And the first time I said, "Wow, I picked up that drink because I was mentally powerless." So now I had the first one quarter of the first step within me. And why did I keep drinking? Because of the physical allergy. 2 shots of whiskey wasn't doing it for me. And I got to tell you, even when I finished that half bottle, in my mind I said, "I know there are some places over here I can get some more. I'll sneak off when these guys go off to sleep." I didn't. And I said, "Wow, that's the physical powerlessness. I'm mentally and physically powerless over alcohol." And I took that first step. I rushed back to Bombay. I was at a meeting that night. And there was a guy speaking that night whom I hadn't heard speak before. His name was Franco C. And he was speaking at Johnny Z's first anniversary. And I heard this guy speak. And that day when he was speaking, he was 16 years sober and he was 36 years old. And he destroyed my last argument for being in AA. Because all along I was saying, "I'm only 22, or 23, or 24, or 25, 26, 27, 28. You guys are all old. I'm not like you." And here was a guy who had got sober at age 20 and was still sober. So I rushed up to him after the meeting and I said, "Dude, you got to sponsor me." He said, "Why?" "What do you mean, why? Aren't you supposed to say yes?" He said, "Absolutely not. I'm not supposed to say yes. I'm supposed to qualify you. I'm supposed to find out whether you're an alcoholic and whether you want to stop drinking for good. And if you don't, I'm sure you can find some other loony bin in here who can allegedly take you through the steps." So I said, "Okay, what do you want to know?" And he said, "Why have you stopped drinking? When's the last time you drank?" I said, "Last night." "Why have you stopped drinking?"
And I looked at him like he had two heads. I said, because I can't. If there was some way I could still drink, I would not be here at your meetings. I would still be out there drinking. I've tried in AA, I've tried out of AA, I've tried other things to stop drinking. Nothing seems to work. There's absolutely no way I can control and enjoy my drinking. But my mind tells me I can. He said, wow, that sounds like a pretty good admission of powerlessness. He said, where are you working? I'm unemployed. So what are you living off your savings? I got about $3 American in the bank. What does your girlfriend say? I'm single again. Good, where are you living? On my grandmother's couch if I'm sober. He said, yeah, your life's unmanageable. You've taken step one. He said, okay, let's go to step two. Do you believe in God? I said, no. He said, I'm really sorry, I can't help you. So what? He said, look, AA is about two things. It's about booze and it's about God. The booze is going to kill you and God is going to save you. So if you are not willing to explore a power greater than yourself, I can't spoil. I never said I'm not willing. He said, oh, you're willing? That's great. That's all step two calls for, is a willingness to believe in a power greater than yourself. Whether you call it God, good orderly direction, get out of debt, group of drunks, whatever you want to call it. I said, but how do I actually go about that? He said, let me help you form your own concept. Now, I had no clue that this guy was working out the big book. But that's what he was doing. And he started talking about, do you have any friends left? Are there any people you admire? I said, yeah, Mother Teresa, Mahatma Gandhi, John Kennedy, and I have these friends. Why? I said, well, they bail me out, they hook me up, they lend me money. He said, okay, let's take a paper and write down all their good qualities. And we sat and we wrote them down. And he said, by some accident, if there's actually a God in this universe, wouldn't you like God to have those qualities? I said, yes. He said, that can be your concept. Your own concept, Roy, however inadequate, is sufficient to make an approach for God as you understand God. I got to tell you, I've never had a problem with my concept of anything. So I thought, that's great. He said, you've done step two. He said, will you do anything I ask you to do? I said, sure. He said, good, kneel down. Said, excuse me? This guy was a cross between Genghis Khan and Attila the Hun. And he said, like this. And he hit his knees right there. You know, I felt embarrassed for the poor sucker. You know, the meeting was over. People were milling about. And this idiot is kneeling down over here. So I knelt down next to him. And he said, repeat after me. If there is a God, please keep me sober today. So I did. He said, get up. And he said, if you're still sober when you get home tonight, you say, if there is a God, thank you. I said, how long do I have to keep up this malarkey? He said, till one of two things happens, till you come to believe or till you drink again. I said, okay. I said, that's it. We are done. He said, no, you said you would do anything I asked you to do. I said, yes. We crossed the street. He bought me a 200-page notebook. And he said, you're starting your first step, your fourth step. And this was my first day back. On the first page he wrote, I am a liar. So we argued for a week because I didn't think I was a liar. He proved that I was a liar. And I started writing my fourth step. Now, I don't know about you guys, but this was India, 1990. Internet wasn't invented. So I tell my son, I got through high school without Google. I'm telling you guys, I got sober without cell phones and without the internet. So that's a pretty cool thing. So he didn't have a phone. I would have to take two buses to go and meet him. I had to meet him every Sunday. So Monday to Saturday, I just goofed off, went for meetings, had a lot of fun. And 2 a.m. Sunday morning, pull out my book, start writing stuff because I got to go and meet him and pretend that I've actually done some fourth step stuff. Just took 2 or 3 months and then I was done. This is really old style AA. He came over to my apartment and sat down, and he started reading through my fourth step. I'm sitting at the other end of the living room. He's making faces, he's making sounds, and he's making notes. So he goes, ooh, ooh, and he's making notes on this paper. And when he was done reading, he said, anything else? I said, no, that's it. He said, what about all that criminal stuff and all that sexual stuff? I said, like what? And he shared freely and easily his own stuff. He said, I told you I worked in cargo. You know, manifested cargo is not the only thing I helped leave the country. And that's all I'm going to say at an open meeting. And the sexual stuff, I went into that fifth step meeting thinking I was some kind of Don Juan. I came out looking like Elmer Fudd compared to his sexual stuff, I'm telling you. But we were done. He said, you don't need this anymore. And we burnt my fourth step in my little barbecue pit. And then he handed me this piece of paper. On one side was a list of all the defects of character he had pulled out of my fourth step. On the other side was all the amends which he had determined that I had to do. He said, I'm going to teach you a new step. Step 7, you now add to your prayer, if there is a God, please take my defects. They will take you out to drink and we don't need your defects. I still hadn't come to believe at this point. I said, now what? He said, now I'm going to teach you step 10. You continue to take personal inventory. The big book says that we start to do step 10 as we clean up the past. So it's really weird usage of language, but you start doing step 10 while you're doing step 9. And he taught me how to look for resentments and fear and self-centeredness. And he said, I'm coming with you to supervise your first amend, which was a financial one. It's not something I recommend, but like I said, he was a cross between Genghis Khan and Attila the Hun, and I wasn't going to argue with him. So we went to make my first amend, which was to the film company that I was working at. So between the crashed motorcycle, the hospital bills, the airfare, the unpaid hotel bills, the bar bills, the other entertainment that I may have signed on, I owed them about 18 grand. So we went to the office and the big book says, arranging the best deal you can. I said, look, I can pay you guys back about $100 a week. And they said, okay, see the accountant on your way out. One of the promises, 9 out of 10 times the unexpected happens. The guy hands me a check for 7 grand. I said, what is this? He said, go and talk to the bosses. So like I said, I was a film production manager. I had set up everything for the film shoot and then had my accident. So they were able to do the whole shoot without hiring somebody to replace me. So they just deducted all the expenses and paid me the balance. Why do I say don't take your sponsor? That check was in my hands for about 23 seconds. And he said, "Woo, we can use this to pay your other amends." Very shortly after that, an incident happened in my life and I came to believe. Something happened that could not have happened without divine intervention. My worst enemy was dying. I would have thrown a block party if I wasn't in the program. Instead, I said, God, if it be your will, and if there's a God that those drunks in AA say there is, you can make this man well or else take away the pain. He died 3 days later pain-free. I dropped the word if and I came to believe. You know, I'm going to share a few of my 12-step experiences. I have been blessed. When I was about 3 years sober, let me just backtrack a second. So when I was about a year sober, I was ready to kill myself. Because 2 seconds before going, now, you know, I always get into this argument at 1 hour meetings. Because you guys tell me 1 hour and then you spend 15 minutes on all your announcements. So actually it's a 45-minute meeting? Or are you going to give me those extra 10 minutes? Okay, that's great. So I'm sober now a year. I've done these 12 steps. I'm going for meetings. And AA in India is very small. There was at that time in 1990 only 100 meetings in the country. I knew everyone's stories. And so I said to my sponsor, this is crazy. I can't keep doing this. Because 2 seconds before the meeting, I put on my AA face. Hey, Roy, how are you doing? Great. One day at a time. Let go, let God. Keep coming back. It works if you work it. In my head, oh my God, I got to listen to his story again. God is good. We had, at that time, we had 100 big books in the country. So if you wanted to read the big book, you came early to the meeting, you bribed the secretary by setting up the whole meeting for you, for him, and then he would lend you the group big book and you could make notes into your notebook. And when the meeting started, the book went back on the table and all was an om. The book stayed sober. Many of us went out. But my sister was in Al-Anon in San Francisco. Any Al-Anons here? Hi, great. So my sister was in Al-Anon and she said to her sponsor, my brother's been sober a year and he's asking me for a big book. Should I send him one? And so she sent me my first copy of the big book. My aunt lived in Australia and she went to the Melbourne Intergroup and said, my nephew in India is really bored with speakers. And God bless that unknown person behind the counter at the Melbourne, Australia Intergroup. He gave my aunt the set of 4 cassette tapes. This was before CDs and other such devices. And he said, tell your nephew to listen to it. 2 American guys called Charlie P. and Joe McHugh. And these guys were talking about the steps out of the Big Book. It was like my brain was exploding. I was listening to what they were saying. I was writing stuff. I was rewinding the tapes. And those that had no tapes, my tape would break. And then you got to unscrew them and use scotch tape. Thank God I see some heads nodding. To splice the tape again and get really resentful because you lost half a sentence. Yeah. So I listened to those tapes. I did the steps again. My whole life changed. I was 3 years, I got my job back in the film business. I was 3 years sober. My company got a project to work for the United Nations. We went around India on a bus. In 6 months, I passed through only 2 towns that had an AA meeting. Like I said, no internet, no cell phones. What did I do? I had my Big Book with me. Every night, I would write a letter to someone in my home group. That was my meeting. Part of my job was to make sure that there was enough booze for the crew to drink at the end of the shoot and any other exotic powders that they might have been looking for. Drag the bodies off to bed and have them all awake the next morning. That was part of my job. I prayed, I did the program, I wrote a letter. Every morning we'd stop in a village to shoot, and once they would be set up, I'd be walking around the village randomly 12-stepping anybody who listened to me, whether they were alcoholic or not. There's got to be somebody over here who has a drinking problem. Before I went to Intergroup. I picked up like a whole lot of pamphlets in different languages. And I left pamphlets everywhere that I went. I have no idea if anybody stayed sober. I stayed sober. When I was about a year sober, a young man came to my home group. The usual story, you know, 26, lost everything, thrown out of the family. He lived in a state in India where there was no AA. This guy would take a train every Friday night, come 8 hours to Bombay. We'd do a meeting together. We'd spend all of Saturday in sponsorship. And then he'd go back and spend the whole week without any meetings. Obviously, no internet and so on and so forth. He did this for 1 year. And at the end of 1 year, my entire home group went to his little village and started the first AA meeting there. We had a public awareness meeting. We talked to the doctors, the police, the hospitals. That guy started AA in that state. And now they have meetings in about 10 different cities. And he's still sober. That's amazing. You know, when I was about 5 years sober, God saw it fit to send me to the Middle East. So I landed up in a country where there was no AA. There was one liquor store. It was owned by the king. They would give us drinking permits, but there was no AA. So every week I'd go to the neighboring country for an AA meeting once a week. And then another guy came into our country and he also had 5 years. So the two of us started the first meeting in the Kingdom of Sharjah in the United Arab Emirates. And we started it in 1996. It's still on. Mark and I would show up every Tuesday night. You again, who did you expect? I'm 50% of the sober population of this country. And then we would drive the U.S. Embassy mad. We'd be calling the U.S. Embassy and saying, hey, any American warships in town?
Sir, that's classified information.
You don't understand. There are guys on that ship that need the meetings.
Sir, that's classified information.
So we're alcoholics. We talk to the taxi drivers. We talk to the young ladies who might have been around accompanying the troops at that time. And then Mark and I would go down to the port with these big signs, any friends of Bill W., and we'd take 2 or 3 unsuspecting sailors. They'd think they're going for a meeting. They didn't realize that Mark and I were the meeting. And that was it. You talk about spiritual experiences. About 15 years ago, I was speaking at the Hicksville Group's anniversary, and a guy came up to me after tears flowing down his face. He said, I'm one of those sailors you picked up in 1996. I had 90 days then, and he had 7 years when you... I mean, I'm getting goose flesh now. Just that's a spiritual experience for me, that kind of stuff. You know, on that trip, the UNICEF trip, I almost died, and I was flown back to Bombay. I was in the ICU, and I took an inventory. I said, what am I doing with my life?
I'm 3 years sober. I speak 3 languages. I have excellent communication skills. I love working with drunks and addicts. I had started volunteering for Mother Teresa. She had a small home for dying destitutes. And I asked, you know, my sister sent me with a food parcel, and some nun collared me at the door and said, "Oh, your sister tells me that you are working with..." I said, "What am I going to..." She said, "That man there is dying. Can you go and talk to him?" I said, "Okay." Before I knew what happened, I was roped into doing 2 alcohol support groups a week. So 3 years later, I had this thing, and I said to myself, "What am I doing with my life? I'm just making money and chasing chicks. That's all I'm doing." So I did a third step. I turned it over, and I realized I would like to spend the rest of my life professionally helping people like me. And God made it possible. I went to the Middle East. Something unexpected happened. I landed here in the USA and started working. On my way to the USA, I stopped over in Amsterdam. I got robbed. I was sitting there. Some guy was walking around with his ticket. And, you know, I was in AA. I was a Boy Scout. I was sober. So I said, "Oh," and I was an ex-airline employee. "Oh, so your ticket's expired. You go to KLM." By the time I was talking to him, his friend walked off with my briefcase, which are thousands of dollars in cash, all my original certificates, the last letter my father wrote to me before he died. I never got any of that back. I landed here with $50 on my ticket and my passport. What did I do? I opened the yellow pages on an AA meeting. I went for the meeting there in Amsterdam. It was in Dutch. And they said, "Oh, fresh meat, tourist." I said, "Listen, I just need to soak up some spirituality." The meeting was in Dutch. I sat at the back with my eyes closed, just praying. A Britisher walked through the door, and he decided that he had wanted to get sober. I was the only one in the room who spoke enough English to 12-step the guy. Spend the rest of the day with him. I don't know what happened to the guy. I'm still sober. Landed here. You know, life went on. I got a great job. I got married in sobriety. You know, I have a young 13-year-old son who's never seen either of us drink. My wife just had 22 years in the program. I'm now getting divorced in sobriety. This is life on life's terms. Don't worry, we both have higher powers. They're called lawyers. So, you know, and I can laugh about it. I would, I have to be respectful. If I, what I actually feel, that's what I pay a therapist for. But the truth is, this is AA. It's a great life. I get to share my experience with people. I get to take people through the book. When I sponsor people now, when they ask me to sponsor them, I ask them, "Can you read?" If they say yes, I said, "Well, page 96 of the big book, it says, page 95, read this book. After you're done reading, if you want to go on, call me." And if they call me, then page 96. You've read the book, that's great. You want to do the steps? Fabulous. And we go through the steps. I'm not one of those people who sit and read the book page by page. I mean, there are other meetings and people who can do that. I'll just take you through the steps. I love Dr. Bob's method of sponsorship. In the 15 years that he was sober, he took 5,000 people through the steps. That book, yeah, it's in the big book. It's in the italics above his story. That works out to 333.36 people a year recovering. I think he took some weekends off. What am I doing today to stay sober? I'm doing the same thing today that I've been doing for the last 25 years. I wake up in the morning, and between the bedroom and the bathroom, I say, "God, please keep me sober today." By saying, "Please keep me sober today," I'm acknowledging that I am as powerless today as I was 25 years ago. By saying, "God, please keep me sober today," I'm acknowledging that I cannot do this on my own power. I need a higher power. That's my second step. Why do I need the second step? You have any doubts that I'm still insane? Every time that stupid... I'm not going to say the brand name because we don't endorse or oppose. Every time there's a certain beer commercial that comes along with white beaches and a bucket and the percolation trickling down, I salivate. I watched that commercial for years before someone told me that there were a couple of blondes in that commercial. Really? I don't even know that. So I'm still insane. While I'm in the shower, I do my own version of step 3 and 7. Take away my difficulties. If you take away my difficulties, then I will help others. I mean, it's a straight deal. If you go to a fast food restaurant and give them $1.07,
They'll give you something from the dollar menu. So step three says, take away my difficulties that victory over them may prove your power to those I may help. You take away the difficulties and I'll do my bit. Step seven, I still don't need the defects. I still can't control them. Take them, bye-bye. And then, I don't recommend this, but I usually start step 11 while I'm in the car driving to work. You know, I consider my plans for the day. Oh, I got to call this one. I got to do that. Remember to shave. Okay, I'll do it while I'm driving. So I'm driving, texting, shaving, doing 11 step, making notes, calling people. And then through the day, I get an opportunity to do a 10th step and a ninth, because I work in a place where a lot of people are in recovery. And randomly through the day, people will walk past my office, especially when I've annoyed somebody, and say, somebody may need to make some amends to somebody. Or they might say, somebody should probably pray or call a sponsor. So I got a chance to do that. Thanks to technology today, and thanks to text messages and emails and cell phones, I have the ability to do a 12th step at so many different times of the day. I can call people, text people, email people. It's a blessing. And the 12th step, when I'm asked to share my experience, when I'm asked to speak at a meeting, when I'm asked to sponsor somebody, I'm only too happy to give it away. You know, when Ron called and asked me to speak, I said yes. You know, maybe one day God will grant me the wisdom to start to ask where before I say yes. But it was still a wonderful trip. I got to close in gratitude for you guys from AA. Because when you figured out how this was done, you Americans did not keep this to yourself. You put this in a book and you sent it all over the world. And the last time I checked, 183 countries, 127,000 meetings, 2.2 million people in 64 languages doing exactly what we are doing right now. Sitting down in a meeting, hoping to identify, hoping for a solution, listening to somebody sharing their experience, strength, and hope. I'd like to close with the prayer that we use in India. God, bless all the alcoholics wherever they may be. Bless those that are sober today. Give grace to those that are on the way. Please, God, show compassion and mercy to those that might never come. Thank you so much for listening.
I'd like to thank Roy one more time for coming all the way down from New York. We will be having the meeting in here next week. We have Bill Borchette coming down from Connecticut. He is the author and the producer of the movie, My Name is Bill W. He's written many books, 1,000 Years of Sobriety. It's on our website. If you don't have a we have a website. We've had a website for a long time. Show speakers lined up for the next 6 months to a year and a half. Please see anybody that, whoever has the website, please put your hand up and let them know so they can get it from you. There you go. There's one person that's got the website. There you go. Roy's got one. Anyway, we're not allowed to smoke anywhere on the property. And we're not allowed to drink any kind of coffee in here. We're going to have the other room set up for coffee and donuts. So please, we'll have some fellowship after the meeting, all the coffee and you can drink and donuts. And we got a nice way of closing. And thank you for all coming out.